This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 17th of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 49th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Just look at this stuff. We've got piles of brilliant things in boxes with marker pen on to remind us of all the great bits we've got lined up. It's going to be a busy show. Pull up a pew. Now, are you sitting comfortably? Then I shall begin. First of all, we're off to the International Radio Festival in Zurich to see what all those other microphone-toting aficionados are doing and check the state of the medium, what you are listening to.
We want to bring people together that go home with new ideas, new friendships that actually then filter into their program, which enhances the listening experience of their own audiences at home.
Second of all, we'll enjoy a super cool Midori House session from a revitalised Tim Burgess, who'll also be telling us about his great new solo record, Oh No, I Love You.
Music tastes are very varied as well, and I can listen to Perk, and I can listen to Factory Floor and Lamb Chop and The Horrors, and I think if I can listen to them, then everyone else must be able to have that kind of broad sense of music as well. You know.
And it's that time of year when Damon Albarn blows his whistle and again plays conductor on everyone's favourite musical train. That's right, boys and girls, it's the Africa Express.
It's been thrilling to see the reaction of people in Middlesbrough and Carlisle and Glasgow and Manchester and Bristol and Cardiff and everywhere else, just getting off on the music and taking such pleasure in everyone coming together like this.
Plus, we'll get our closing report from the Toronto Film Festival, and our lady in Berlin will provide us with a wonderful insight into the goings-on at last week's Art Week in the German capital. First things first, while we shuffle our papers and set dials to Radio Loveliness, we'll play you a new song from Tim Burgess's upcoming solo record called Oh No, I Love You. Tim came in to perform a Midori House session last week, and his first track was this, White.
The season is over us now. Never got into the town. Passes me like you will come. The one that we left in a bar. Next to the old magazines and pictures of your family, dressed all in white like that fall. Missed it all. Missed the ending. Missed the text we were sending. Missed the score. I miss you more. She'll get so. Heartbreak on hold. Colors for young kids and punks, readers and writers need none. Lines that are left on a page, positive, negative space. Black is the blend of all color. Lightning at night turns the sky white with the absence of fear. Missed it all. Miss the ending. Miss the text we were sending. Miss the skull. I miss you more. She'll get so. Heartbreak on hold. Heartbreaks on hold. Heartbreak on hold. Heartbreaks on hold. Heartbreaks on hold.
Thanks very much.
That was White, performed live for us lucky lot by Tim Burgess last week. More from Tim later. Now to Zurich, where last week the International Radio Festival took place. The event was founded 2 years ago to celebrate one of the world's most popular things, music radio. It's already become a key date in the industry calendar, with 25 stations from around the world pitching up with their DJs to broadcast live from the Schloss Silberg, where the event took place, and attend various talks and workshops with radio aficionados from across the industry. We dispatched Monocle producer Dawn Trump to the event. Why? Because Dawn is like a magician with a microphone, that's why. And lo, now we all get to know what the wonderful world of music radio sounds like without having to adjust our sets.
I'm in a castle in Zurich. There are people all around me from different corners of the globe wearing jeans and T-shirts, speaking in different languages. This is the third edition of the International Radio Festival, a place where people have come to hear how the world sounds. It's an amazing amalgamation of different voices in a diverse sonic landscape.
We play mostly forgotten gems and future classics like soul funk, jazz, good hip-hop.
Love songs, 70, 80, 90, oldies, like 60. And we have at nighttime music from youngster, like boom, boom, boom.
Daryl von Daniken is the founder of the festival.
The festival's core aim is to celebrate music radio, which is the world's most consumed medium. So on the one hand, we provide a platform for invited radios to showcase their radio shows, their music radio shows. On the other hand, there's never been a platform where music radio can trade on the basis like they have TV conferences, for example, MIP and MIPCOM. It hasn't existed before.
But while radio aficionados from around the world have gathered to discover, enjoy, and celebrate the music they love and the stations they represent, this isn't the only thing on the agenda. Seminars litter the daytime schedule, and one theme is still dominant. Despite it being 2012, over a decade since the internet revolution began to impact on the future of commercial broadcasting and the guarantee of advertising revenues, the commercial stations here are still asking how they survive and stay profitable in an increasingly digital landscape.
For us, radio is curated music as a program with a bit of education behind it. Education just from the point of view of this is so-and-so and it's called that and maybe some more background. Because without radio, there is no music business. You don't hear about it, therefore you can't go and buy it, you can't download it, you can't steal it, you can't share it. There are no charts. There's nothing. Radio is the biggest distributor of music as we know it and always will be. It's only once you've heard it on the radio that you actually may go and look for it on iTunes or wherever.
The global landscape isn't uniform. In countries such as South Africa and India, the medium of radio continues to grow, as Tarachand Wanvavi from Indian Television explains.
India has, at present, 245 FM stations, and these are privately run stations. The future for Indian radio is great. It's huge, it's terrific, and it's the cheapest form of getting yourself entertained. So over the next few years, it should only grow. We're talking in terms of a $300 million industry that could only grow upwards to billion plus over the next few years.
But though markets such as India are in a fortunate position, many are still going through a difficult period of transition. Georgina Chang is from Lush Radio Station in Singapore. She explains some of the challenges of appealing to a younger, internet-savvy demographic.
For a station like 97, the biggest challenge, obviously, is to stay relevant to the young listeners, because that listenership is dropping. For a station like Lush, the challenge is to continue to grow the audience and also entice advertisers to realize that this is not a mass station, but this very targeted audience who like the finer things in life.
It's surprising when you see how far technology has evolved that some stations are still working in the same way as they did 15 years ago. On one hand, radio can still have a huge influence on music sales. But the old linear model of radio delivery often now fails to generate the listener numbers and the advertising revenue needed to support this infrastructure. One company that is working to develop the way music and curated content are made available to a more dynamic audience is Mixcloud. Nikhil Shah is one of the company's founders.
People often talk about kind of, is this going to kill that? Is this going to replace that? When it comes to innovations in any industry, actually, but particularly in media. And actually, I think a lot of things can coexist, especially in music, because I'm sure everyone out there who's listening knows different people who consume music in different ways. Some people are passionate lean forward consumers and discoverers of music, whereas other people just want to lean back and let it come to them. Some people love discovering through their friends, some people hate it. Some people want to buy vinyl still. I run a record label and we actually produce vinyl. In fact, I'm just releasing in a few weeks a vinyl-only run with 300 units, no digital, which kind of sounds mad to people that don't understand that world, but actually, well, I'm really excited about it and that song is going to be amazing. So there are a lot of different types of, you know, segments of consumers.
Not everyone believes radio has a healthy future, as Scott Cohen, founder of The Orchard, a digital music distribution company, explains.
I think curation, recommendation is absolutely part of the future. How it's done is going to change dramatically. The infrastructure around traditional radio isn't sustainable. However, if you have a person that is somehow trusted, their opinion matters a lot. But so does technology as a curator of music. And I can create a playlist from a machine that is indistinguishable from a human's playlist. And if I want to do a top 40 playlist of all the hit tracks, if I want to look at more obscure music or dance music or classic rock or you name it, I can have a machine create a playlist that you wouldn't know that was done by a machine.
Whether Scott is right, or as I'd like to think, not, there's definitely a party happening here. I don't think we're at the edge of the precipice just yet. And every party has its wildcards, right? Q Radio Nula, a pirate station from Slovenia.
My name is Irvin. Basically, I'm representing Radio Nula. It's a pirate radio station based in Slovenia.
My name is Ozo. That's my radio name. And I'm basically selecting, I'm DJ on the radio and selecting all the music. We're funding our radio station by ourselves because it's basically just a streaming server. And we actually have very good friends that are offering a streaming server for free for us. So basically, like, we are kind of a pirate radio. We are not paying anything and we are not earning anything. So it's like commercial free 24/7 good music.
So pirates aside, and presuming we're not yet at death's door, what is the best way for a station to achieve audience recognition and commercial success while still retaining control of their editorial content? It's a question we once tackled here at Monocle, and as Tommy Partanen and Mika Samakari from Finnish station Basso Media also reflected, it comes down to one central idea: the strength of your brand.
Our streaming and online content is very important to us because our whole company was initially community-based, so the origins are in the discussion forum. We have a very active group of followers. We have to sort of deliver to them in all the ways that suit their taste and their accustoms with Basso.
For established stations who are still struggling to adapt to the internet, it could well be a rocky road ahead. The challenge for commercial stations lies in finding faith again in content and identity, and then convincing advertisers to come along for the ride. But regardless of the future, curator or computer algorithm, there's one thing for certain here in Zurich. You work in broadcasting not for the money, but for the love of it. And there's still a lot of love to go round.
We want to bring people together that go home with new ideas, new friendships, that actually then filter into their programme, which enhances the listening experience of their own audiences at home.
For Monocle, in Zurich, I'm Dawn Trump.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, here on Monocle 24. Now for part two of our Toronto Film Festival doubleheader. Cast your mind back to last week when Jason Anderson, film critic for Toronto weekly The Grid, peered sagely into his critical crystal ball to tell us what movies were going to rock the festival, often a bellwether, remember, for Oscar glory. This week we're delving into the festival proper as Mars Sellers attends some parties, interviews some directors, gets real. Here's our report.
Downtown is like incredibly buzzing.
And there are all these people that were like so overdressed up. And
there's like a buzz of film festival atmosphere happening everywhere.
tottering around on their heels and pinballing off the walls, and it was like they had way too much free wine.
I mean, it's really interesting walking around the city at this time too, because I feel like a lot of the city becomes so involved in it, you can just sort of eavesdrop on what people are seeing as well, and sort of pick up on things like that.
In mid-September, the film industry ascends to Toronto, Canada, for what some say is the second most important film festival in the world, after Cannes. The Toronto International Film Festival, known to locals and industry professionals as TIFF. Kiva Reardon, staff writer at In the Movies, about the different sides of TIFF.
I guess the way it's normally covered is there's the red carpet TIFF. So this is, you know, like, Kristen Stewart's coming for the first time since she cheated on our Pats, that kind of thing. And, you know, no one even talks about that. On the Road is a really bad film because they just want to see her. So that's, you know, that's one TIFF. And sometimes those movies, like the mainstream ones, are, you know, they're really good as well. Like Looper, the opening night one, is you know, quite good. So, you know, there's still reasons to pay attention to that. But then there's also, you know, there's documentary films which sort of draw a different crowd as well. There's always, you know, the Canadian program. Then there's city to city. So every year the festival picks a different city that pairs it with. So this year it's Mumbai. So there's films coming out of that.
In the midst of so much programming, indie films are still looking for a platform. Jalene Kane, an actress in new Irish indie film, Jump.
I would say it's about the lives of six 20-somethings whose stories all collide over one fateful night, which is New Year's Eve. And it's kind of how the three stories merge together and are resolved at the end of the night, at the end of the content of New Year's Eve.
They had quite an interesting PR campaign.
Yeah, because we're Irish and our film is an Irish film directed and produced by Irish men, I think they thought that the perfect way to promote our film was by doing an upscale pub crawl through Toronto, which is kind of crazy. We like hit four or five different Irish bars and sort of tried to spread the word about the film and try and get as many people to come see it.
And then there's the people who haven't even made their films yet and are here pitching and trying to fit in business between screenings. Jonathan Orr and Murray Sippel, writer and director of the yet-to-be-made film The Legitimate Complaints of a Seriously Injured Individual.
That the title actually comes from a legal document that was prepared by Murray's lawyers when he was injured in a car accident by a drunk driver, and he wasn't actually hurt in the car accident. The actual paralyzing happened when he was taken to the hospital. So our film, at this point, that we're pitching here at TIFF, chronicles his story.
And we are coming from Vancouver. It's a small town, really, in the scope of things, and TIFF is, I think, third largest on the scale of film festivals. There's business to do here. When we have a film festival in Vancouver, it's more about going to see the films, maybe some little parties, but we came to TIFF for business. That's really why.
Canadians are often known for focusing on their homegrown talent, but this year, TIFF made some changes. Norm Wilner, film critic, explains.
The only major difference this year from my perspective is probably that the Canadian cinema is struggling a little bit more to get noticed just because they no longer have the Canada First program. Previously, if you wanted to go and focus exclusively on Canadian cinema, you had that option. There were Canadian programs. This year, kind of on your own, you have to, you know, start looking and searching and digging. The problem with breaking up the Canadian cinema now is that it's harder for emerging talent to emerge. Like Sarah Polley, Deepa Mehta, even Xavier Dolan, they don't have any trouble. They're going to be fine. Their movies will get seen, and that will have no trouble getting that word out. But the smaller films are going to have a struggle. There's a movie called Tower that I've been chasing for a couple of weeks. I just haven't been able to see the damn thing, but everybody I know seems to love it. So I'm really excited to see it. I believe it's in the Discovery program. The problem is if I didn't know it was Canadian already, I wouldn't know.
And the less Canadian presence isn't just focused on the screenings. It's affecting the rest of the business as well, as Jonathan and Murray explain.
Well, for an example, Telefilm isn't even here, which is our national funding agency for feature film, and they don't have representatives here.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why they're not here. And in some ways, that's like, it's sort of like, oh my God, it's a little frightening. I mean, considering the cuts that are happening to the NFB and to Telefilm and to all our cultural institutions, it's frightening to see the actual physical realization of that, that these people just aren't, they don't have the presence that they've had in past festivals. They're not here, and it's a bit scary. And that's kind of why Murray and I want to try and kind of maybe bypass that normal route and really get hooked in with a big producer this time, with a UK producer potentially or an American producer. And Toronto's awesome for that because people are here with checkbooks. Like, that's, it's a buyer's festival. They're here to buy movies.
And what else do people buy when they make a film? Music. Music plays an important role in the shaping of a film's feel and sound. It's also an important income revenue for musicians in the current climate of declining record sales. The Canadian music industry has put together a showcase festival exclusively for the film music licensing buyers. Festival Music House runs for 3 days in conjunction with TIFF at the Mod Club in Toronto. Local record label Arts and Crafts are producing the event. Head organizer Marcello Favia.
The main goal, I guess, is to be able to showcase some of what Canada has to offer in terms of music for film industry people who could potentially use some Canadian music in some of their upcoming projects. Music licensing is really important nowadays because the declining record sales that everyone's been talking about forever. It's another income stream for an artist, and we have some artists who are basically putting their kids through college because of music licensing their songs. So it's really become a really important asset for young bands especially, and also for established acts like Jason Collette, who's playing here. He's been doing this for 20 years, but has licensed more stuff, and he's one of our top earners for music licensing. So he found it to be an extremely important part of his career, and we imagine the same for every other artist involved.
Expanding every year with more broad business and industry, TIFF has grown, but it's still a film festival. So what was everyone's favorite film?
My top three films are Amour, the Michael Haneke film, which won the Palme d'Or, which is just this emotional, sadistic, devastating drama about an elderly couple deteriorating right in front of your eyes.
Probably the best thing that I've seen at TIFF this year has been a film by Miguel Gomes called Taboo.
And then Polly's film, Stories We Tell, which is an exceptional blending of documentary and not fiction, but artifice, let's say.
I actually think is the Julian Temple doc about London called London.
And then the third one is Leviathan, which is this amazing experimental documentary about the American commercial fishing industry, which you would not expect would be visceral and gripping and thrilling, but it's like having your head held underwater for 80 minutes. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I got cornered by a couple who just like saw my pass and like physically blocked me on the sidewalk and said, "What did you just see? What are you going to see?" And then like asked me questions about it and then debated amongst themselves right afterwards. So like, that's kind of a good technique too, is talk to people who've seen films and ask them, just corner them on the street, because that's the awesome thing. It's like I'm looking out right now. There's people lined up everywhere. Just go and talk to people, because everyone's so stoked about all the films they've seen. And it's just like, ask and go, what's good?
For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Mar Sellers.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're hopping on board the Africa Express next. Choo-choo!
The Venice Architecture Biennale is a heady place to take the temperature of the industry and a good place to forecast its future. Monocle Films was there to do both.
As the industry flocked to Venice for the 13th Architecture Biennale, it was greeted by a storm of biblical proportions, which rolled into the lagoon out of nowhere. Even the greatest cynic pondered if this might be punishment for previous gaudy, expensive, ego-driven projects. But even these clouds had silver linings. As they tumbled away, they revealed a Venice that looked better than ever.
Architecture on film, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture here on Monocle 24. British musician Damon Albarn has been well known for yonks for his love of Malian music, and that love has spread across that great continent to encompass and incorporate all sorts of other beats and rhythms. His Africa Express collective of artists from various nations has been staging what he describes as unrehearsed and unapologetic performances for several years. But when he heard that the UK's Cultural Olympiad wanted to give him some dosh to end the festival with a bang, it was time to take Africa Express to the next level. Alban decided to amass a band of over 80 Western and African acts, pop them on an old 1970s train, and drive them around the country. Amadou and Mariam and Baba Mal shared window seats with the Noisettes, Carl Barat, and Nick Zinner of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, to name just a few. Monocle producer Katie Bilbao was keen to hear what life had been like on the Africa Express, so she went down to King's Cross Station to wave the travelling troupe home at their final destination and hear from co-founder Ian Birrell.
The project was basically launched to share our love of African music and bring together people to create music without boundaries. And it's all about the music, it's about the artists, it's about exploring, and it's about everyone learning from each other. And that's what this whole thing has been about, this most incredible journey of exploration. And it's been thrilling to see the reaction of people in Middlesbrough and Carlisle and Glasgow and Manchester and Bristol and Cardiff and everywhere else, just getting off on the music and taking such pleasure in everyone coming together like this.
John Paul Jones. I used to be with several older bands, Led Zeppelin, Them Crooked Vultures. Do you know any of those? Amazing energy, amazing bunch of people, and lots of different music, you know, and that's the whole thing, is everybody's getting together and just trying out their stuff with each other, you know, and this lovely cross movement of ideas. It's very rhythmic and very energetic. I mean, there's quite a range. And there's quite a range in Africa alone. I mean, between the gentle, more gentle Malian music and the Congolese stuff, which is just absolutely crazy.
When the Olympics came to us, we said we wanted to take a train around Britain. So we knew that was the only way that we would ever do it. So yeah.
And what is it about train travel that you think was essential for this particular idea?
I think there was something very beautiful about everyone being in one place rather than on buses or cars, in old-fashioned rolling stock, with the space to rehearse and to hang out and to make new friends and make musical acquaintances. And from the second everyone got on, the train somehow was a very special part of the journey in creating the space that allowed the artists to do all the incredible things they've done. I guess in total we've probably seen over 120 different artists, but we've seen everyone from great well-known African artists such as Baba Mal, such as Amadou, such as Rokia Traore, through to some of the young guard like Spoke Mutombo, whose cover of a Joy Division song has been a huge hit in so many places, to Balaji. From the western side, we've had bands like the Australian band Temper Trap, we've had John Paul Jones join us, we've had the Noisettes join us, we've had Maxwell Park join us up in Middlesbrough. It's just been incredible the way all the time people have been coming on and getting off, and just everyone getting into this amazing mood. And the artists have all seen it as something quite life-changing, which makes me very humble to have been part of that.
Can you just describe what you're wearing today?
I'm just wearing like a slightly sort of see-through white kind of, it's kind of like a festival-y dress type thing with some brogues and a massive sort of tropical headgear. What's been inspiring people has been changing and evolving into something more wild and wonderful every day. It's beautiful.
Hey, how are you doing? I'm Spook Mutombo from Johannesburg, South Africa.
You've travelled here especially to be part of this project. How has it been for you? And tell me about the experience.
Words cannot even describe. It's one of the biggest musical experiences of my life. Travelling around the country with a bunch of, 80 musicians in total, and everybody super talented, super skilled, a lot of legends as well. you know, people who've been doing it on a big level since as far as the 60s and 70s, so it's cool. I did a cover of a Joy Division song called She Lost Control, and then Peter Hook came and played it with me in Manchester, and that was epic. John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin played with us, Tony Allen's been on the train with us, Baba Miles with us the whole way. So there's that level. Then there's the other level of just new discovery, discovering like bands I didn't know about before, which are really exciting. Yeah. You know, we turn up at a station in Carlisle and Ethiopian music starts playing and Congolese music starts playing, which must be quite alien music to a lot of people. And instantly they're enjoying it, because at the end of the day, it's not necessarily Ethiopian music or Congolese music, it's great music. And people everywhere around the world love great music. And instantly people got off on it, and it was incredible to see, you know, in a place where people going about their daily life and going to work or out shopping or whatever, suddenly stumble across African music and start dancing.
Those are some of the voices from the Africa Express, including its co-founder Ian Birrell, accompanied by music from Athol Bokoum and Damon Albarn, amongst others. Still to come in part two, we'll hear more from that rather lovely live session from Tim Burgess, and we'll have a chat with him. We'll also visit what might just be the art-making capital of the world, Berlin, for its Art Week. First up, from that great Midori House session last week, this is Tim Burgess with The Doors of Them.
Time be deranged. Devout and pure, the artless face of sense, both steadfast and demure, we do, oh no, I love you, hello, hello. I love you. Ooh. One of the girls none of the flowers a kiss the wine the thanks we touched each other's hand below, oh no, I love you, hello, hello, I love you. A kiss, the wine, the thanks. We touched each other's hand below, oh no. I love you. Hello, hello. I love you.
Thanks a lot.
That was Tim Burgess doing The Doors of Then from his new album, Oh No, I Love You. After he'd put the mic down, Tim swung by the studio for a chat about music making, writing, and the best way to get around London, on the Victoria Line, of course.
It was recorded in Nashville in September last year, and it was written between April and September last year with Kurt Wagner.
Brilliant, Firm Lamb Chop.
Firm Lamb Chop.
Yeah. Does recording in Nashville kind of give it a certain kind of, does it give it inevitable kind of sheen, a bit of Dust Bowl Americana kind of slips in there? Can you deny it?
I can't deny it. I mean, it was put to me. Someone tried to sow an idea that I should do an album traveling around America or something like that. And I didn't really like the idea in full. But then I remembered that in the year 2000, I was helping Kurt. He did a solo gig in Manchester, and I helped him to carry his guitar and his amp back to his van. And on him leaving, it's like, you know, I said to him, "Oh, we should write a song together." And so, although I didn't like this idea of traveling around the southern states of America writing songs, I thought maybe I should just give Kurt a call and see what he's up to. And he said he had 2 weeks free, so I went over and he helped me to choose the right hotel in mid Nashville.
So someone like Kurt Wagner, you'd imagine kind of is kind of like he can kind of plug himself into the Nashville mains, right?
Well, he's I'm not sure. I think he was born there and then moved to Atlanta and then moved back. Or he's definitely been there a long time. And he was a punk, didn't really understand the whole, you know, the Nashville scene as it's recognized, but has himself found his own way of plugging himself in, like you say, to the scene. So, you know, I called him, we wrote for 2 weeks, and then it was suggested that I would come back and we'd use certain people, and, you know, I'm a fan of Lamb Chop, and used a few members of Lamb Chop and a few assorted musicians from Nashville.
The record's got, as you said, you obviously wrote it before you recorded it. Do the two things, does the writing of it in one place and the recording of it in another kind of change how it sounds in the end? Do you kind of make a lot of changes when you're in the studio with Kurt, or was it kind of quite a straight down the line process from writing to recording?
It's a really good point because I, as I said, you know, wrote it in Nashville, or a lot of it. And I came back to London and, you know, added a few more songs here and there. But I didn't want to do any recording in Britain. I thought I could demo extensively, or I could do a lot of work here and then go back with it. But I just thought some things are just, I wanted to save it and just go there and do it all as one, and just it to be a Nashville record. You know, I didn't want to wear a cowboy hat or anything like that. I didn't want to sing in a fake American accent. I wanted it to be Northern Britain.
It does. It's got. I mean, it's, people describe things as a lovely record. It kind of is a lovely record. It's got a sense of pastoral about it. Your voice sounds very sweet on it. The production sounds very straightforward. It sounds made rather than produced, if you know what I mean. It just sounds recorded, which is a nice thing. Is that the kind of sound you were kind of going for?
I wanted to capture Nashville in the 2 weeks that I had to do it. And
I think people stay there for a lot longer and don't manage it.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I just thought, you know, I mean, I wanted to work at this place, the studio called The Beach House, and the producer was a guy called Mark Nevers, who does a lot of the Lamb Chop stuff. Mm. And he was one of two people that I was considering. But I think I made the right choice, definitely.
Yeah. And lyrically, kind of where are you coming from with the record? It's called Oh No, I Love You. And I said it as I say.
Yeah.
In my humble opinion, it sounds kind of like a lovely record, right?
Yeah.
Are there some love songs on it? Is it reflective? You wrote a memoir that came out in the summer, didn't you? Is it sort of coming from a similar place to that, or is it kind of looking forward?
Yeah, it was definitely in the present and looking forward. Mm. The memoir was obviously about the past, but it did take me up to
look
the
behind
present,
you.
Kind of. Yeah, exactly. I came up with a few ideas, and I passed the majority of the words on to Kurt because he's a fantastic lyricist, and he was my friend when I was having it was a weird patch in my life. I had a foot in Los Angeles and another foot, actually, probably all up to my knee in London, and I was kind of, you know, torn between two cities, and actually was falling in love with London again, to be honest. And he said, "I'll be your mirror," which I thought was a really great thing to say, you know, with a collaboration.
Yeah.
But, you know, I gave him some ideas, and we would have coffee every morning, and he would, you know, shape what we talked about into the melodies that I'd given him and a few fragments of words here and there, and he'd discard some. And
it's quite a nice way of kind of doing a collaboration, yeah. I'll Be Your Mirror. Yeah. It's a great Velvet Underground song.
It's a great Velvet Underground song.
Who dressed as Nico?
Yeah.
In those sessions?
Well, it probably would be me.
It's the blonde hair.
It's the blonde hair. Yeah,
and you're taking, obviously, the band on the road. The record comes out on the 1st of October.
Yeah.
And you're doing sort of smaller sessions for us and stuff, I guess, before that. Yeah. When does the tour start?
The tour starts in the middle of October.
Yeah.
We're starting off in Aberdeen and playing Union Chapel.
Yeah.
Thecla in Bristol, you know, fantastic.
Yeah, cool. And these are the it must be nice to revisit these places, you know, and the Charlatans going from medium to bigger venues.
Yeah.
Kind of playing some of those other venues. And also the personnel obviously aren't the old band.
No.
How does that work when your name's on it solely and you're the focus rather than being different, I guess, to being in the Charlatans, right?
It's weird. In the Charlatans, you know, people do ask me to do quite a lot of interviews, but I kind of know that. Well, I do feel more alone, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But then I suppose.
But then you've written the album. It's all your stuff. You can take a bit more ownership of what you're saying, right?
Yeah. But it feels good. But it's and it feels new too. So it's kind of, you know, I'm not entirely comfortable in my new suit yet.
And that's the I'll Be Your Mirror stuff. What's going on with that?
I don't know where it's come from. It must be just, but I mean the acoustic version of White, it sounded very Velvet to me. It must be a day for Nico and Lou.
It must be on loop. What's going on the iPod as soon as you get back on the tube.
Yeah.
And is it going? Is it you taking it further afield? I know that the Charlatans were always. Did I see you at Fuji Rock? Have you played Fuji Rock?
Yeah, we played Fuji Rock.
You're always massive in Japan as much as everywhere else. As well.
I mean, Japan's been incredible for the Charlatans. Yeah. It's always been, you know, the second biggest place that we'd ever been after Britain. It's a great place to go. I mean, it's one of my favourite places in the world, you know.
Yeah. And I wonder how, when you're promoting a record on your website, there's one of the tracks. I think it's track one, isn't it? Is it White that's on the website?
There's a video of it, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder how much do you give away and how much do you want people to... Obviously, you want people to... Because it's your own label as well, isn't it? Ogenesis.
Yeah.
How much do you kind of decide what to give away and what to keep back for the people that are going to buy the album? It's tough, right?
Well, I think most people felt that White was an obvious choice of a single, and I loved it from the minute that we did it. I just, you know, I was thrilled by the recording of that one. I've done Factory Floor and the band Walls.
Yeah.
Sam from Walls approached me and said, I'd like to do remixes of some of your tracks. And I thought, all right, that's a good idea. And I after a while, I started to think about. You know, the Gil Scott-Heron remix album.
Yeah.
Jamie XX did. Yeah. And I just thought, it'd be what a brilliant idea. Let's have remixes for the whole of the album and call it Oh No, I Love You Too. So we've done that, and I'm quite happy to give... I've given a Perk remix away. A Horrors remix of Doors of Then, which I think have gone down really well too. So it kind of adds another aspect to the record and just... I think
give it an extra depth and explore some of those beats.
Yeah, because it's like a collaboration with a guy from Nashville, and then having it remixed by Perk. You know, it's obscene, really. You know,
and it must be nice to give these ideas a bit of extra legs and get sort of be able to sort of spread them out a little bit.
Well, and also because, you know, I mean, music tastes are very varied as well, and I can listen to Perk and I can listen to Factory Floor and Lamb Chop and the Horrors, and I think if I can listen to them, then everyone else must be able to have that kind of broad sense of music as well, you know.
What a cool man Tim Burgess is, and we'll play one of those remixes at the end of the show to boot. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Of course you are. Where else would you be getting this?
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. But they help make a city. You'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in, that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Last week, the first official city-sanctioned Berlin Art Week saw galleries, museums and even art fairs like Art Berlin Contemporary finally joining forces and cooperating. With openings, parties, previews, private dinners, museum award ceremonies, even the unveiling of a new private collection exhibition in an old war bunker, the city literally burst with visual art and the art crowd that goes with it. Funny enough, the week's gems were often found in slightly off-the-beaten-path exhibitions. One of the best was that of Scottish Turner Prize winner Douglas Gordon, this year's winner of the Berlin Akademie der Künste's Käthe Kollwitz Prize. As part of the prize, Gordon mounted a show of one of his ongoing conceptual works called Pretty Much Every Film and Video Work from About 1992 Until Now. Berlin correspondent Kim Bradley caught up with Gordon as he was installing the exhibition.
If you were in the room here at Akademie der Künste in Berlin, you would probably be kind of a bit overwhelmed by the amount of visual images. I think we have something like 95 old-style TVs, actually, and they're showing the various video and film works that I've made since 1992.
This is part of the Käthe Kollwitz Prize. Can you tell me how you won this prize, like what the procedure was with the selection, etc.?
Up until recently, I didn't know that this prize existed. And I mean, I've been lucky enough in life to win quite a few prizes, and I thought my time had come and I'd run out of prizes. And then suddenly someone, a friend of mine, Miroslav Balka, I think we were wandering around Paris actually together doing, he was doing an exhibition in the Marais, I was doing something in the Pigalle, and in between the Marais and the Pigalle he said, do you know about the Käthe Kollwitz Prize? I think that it could be really interesting if you were interested in it, and do you know the building, this Akademie der Kunst? So being a good, diligent, sometimes academic, I did a lot of research on this, and I suddenly remembered actually that when I was a teenager in Scotland, Käthe Kollwitz was incredibly important to me, and I still have a book, probably the first art book that I ever bought when I was about 14, is a kind of history of Käthe Kollwitz. So the prize has a huge significance for me because it relates back to my teenage years, which of course are only about 10 years ago, since I'm only 24 now. And, you know, what she represented to me, I suppose, then, she still represents now, and I have a big affinity with that anti-war kind of proto-feminist stance. Actually, I was saying to someone earlier that, you know, if Käthe Kollwitz was alive now, she would be demonstrating against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she would probably be working with Chicks on Speed. And since I've worked with Chicks on Speed, it makes perfect sense to be having this prize.
How did you choose this piece to be the exhibition connected to the prize?
There's something of a circle involved here, that the first time I showed a version of this work was in 1998 or 1999, maybe. And that was in Poland. And I showed it in a gallery, which Miroslav Balka had showed in years before. We didn't know each other at that time. But I was in Berlin at that time, and I flew from Berlin to Poland, and I came up with the idea on the flight back from Warsaw to Berlin. So there's the work was essentially born in Berlin, but has never been shown here. And now by the time 1992 to 2012, you see something like 80 pieces of work over 95 different monitors, different televisions. And when I sometimes look and I say, my God, 80 pieces of work I've been overproducing. And then I remember it's 20 years of work. So that means I only make 4 works a year. So I should definitely work harder. So that Scottish work ethic thing is still hanging on my shoulder. But no, I thought it was appropriate that a piece conceived of in Berlin originates in Poland, comes back to Berlin.
How do you feel about the Berlin art world?
I think one of the reasons why I liked living here when I arrived here 5 years ago was that it was anonymous, or I was anonymous in it. You know, I have good friends here in the art world, but I don't have a gallery here, which suits me absolutely fine. But, you know, as time has gone on, you know, something like this prize makes me a little bit more visible. And also that a recent project of mine was to buy some space on Kurfürstenstrasse, which would be for my archive and my studio, but it's too big for just me. So actually we had a little opening in the Hof at Kurfürstenstrasse yesterday with some friends of mine at Zomert & Kohl Gallery and Suportico Lopez. So if I keep renovating, if I still get the money to renovate that building completely, it should be full of artists and galleries. So it should make an interesting little community of mutual assistance, which I think is one of the things that really struck me about Berlin after living in New York, which wasn't necessarily a community of mutual assistance. And actually Berlin reminded me of Glasgow back in the 1980s and 90s, that it was more likely that someone would help you than piss on you.
And that was Douglas Gordon talking to Kimberly Bradley, and that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be celebrating our 50th show. Katie will bake the cake, Holly's going to bring the pop, I'll make a little speech, and we'll invite you, dear listeners, to blow out the candles. For the time being, you've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fish has been a bloody star again. Time for one final song this week. This is Tim Burgess's Hours, remixed by Tandy Love. Thanks for tuning in.
Only night darkens the earth.